Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with Barbara Van Renterhem, editorial director, and Tiffany Mayberry, digital editor of the magazine. Today's episode will feature Barbara's interview with a panel of the Food Safety Prevention Control Alliance's lead instructors. That's FSPCA for those of you who love an acronym as much as we do, who will discuss food safety training in the age of COVID, where virtual is the only reality. They discuss training platforms, how virtual training differs from in-person training, and what the future holds. And for those of you who may not be aware, FSPCA is internationally recognized as the trusted source for curricula, training programs, and outreach for the prevention-oriented standards of the Food Safety Modernization Act. Acronym alert, FSMA. We want to thank our friend and previous guest on the podcast, Kathy Gombas. That was the very well-received episode 26, who is a member of FSPCA's steering committee, and most importantly, regular listeners will appreciate that, and most importantly, a member of Food Safety Magazine's editorial advisory board for spearheading today's discussion. So thank you, Kathy. And speaking of virtual, before we started recording today, we got notification that this year's IAFP conference is going virtual. So, to get more information on the three-day event that's being held October 26th through the 28th, visit their website, foodprotection.org, where you can get all the details.
Thank you, Dave Tharp.
Yes. I'm not going to say we were waiting or anything, but tap, tap, tap. You know, one of the things that I miss most about conferences is getting to meet our Food Safety Matters audience. So, you, yes, you, all y'all. Ever since we started the podcast, it was always such a sweet surprise to have people come up to the booth, or in Barbara's case, sessions, wherever she might be, and have you tell us that you listen to the podcast and share your experiences, maybe what your favorite episodes were or what you found most supportive about the podcast. So we miss you guys. We really do. So maybe until we can get back on the road again, maybe you can drop us an email at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com. That's podcast. Adam always likes me to emphasize that so you all know. podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com. So we can get to know you better. We can't take a picture with you or give you a sticker or a button, but I don't know, maybe we could. I could always send you a sticker. Anyway, we miss you. Send us an email. All right. Now, at long last, it's time for the news.
U.S. health officials have named onions from Bakersfield, California-based Thompson International as a source of an ongoing Salmonella Newport outbreak that previously had no known source but was associated with nearly 400 illnesses in 34 states. Thompson International issued a voluntary recall of their red, yellow, white, and sweet yellow onions shipped since May 1st of this year. Onions were distributed to wholesalers, restaurants, and retail stores in all 50 states, Washington, D.C., and Canada. An outbreak with a similar genetic fingerprint is also being investigated in Canada. As of August 2nd, 120 illnesses in 7 Canadian provinces have been confirmed. Canada was the first to identify onions as the source of the outbreak.
I'm just happy that I grow my own onions. That's all I I know.
Yeah. Well, so Canada. But Barbara, you say that Canada's first a lot.
They often point the finger first and identify the source first.
See, and there you are with the pointing of the finger, and yet you put the kibosh on me saying,
but that's a good thing.
For our South Park fans, blame Canada.
No, I would say they should say, give Canada the credit.
Yes, well, Canada gets some credit here, the credit for being the first. So it is interesting that they're many times the first. But we caught up pretty quickly on this one, though. So I guess it's still ongoing, though, a little bit, right? So we'll keep an eye on that one.
Well, what they're investigating, they don't know what caused the contamination of the onions.
Okay.
The actual source. So.
All right.
In a webinar last week about the 2020 Leafy Greens STEC Action Plan, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced a new protocol for the development and registration of antimicrobial treatment for pre-harvest agricultural water. This new testing protocol was developed by experts at FDA's Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition and the EPA, and is intended to help companies develop data on the effectiveness of their products in inactivating pathogens like E. coli or Salmonella in pre-harvest ag water. According to FDA, there are currently no registered antimicrobial treatment products that are authorized to control microorganisms of public health significance for use on agricultural fields or for treatment of irrigation water systems or ponds. EPA's approval of this protocol means that companies may use the data developed using the protocol to support registration of new treatment products or amendments to current product labels for use against foodborne pathogens in pre-harvest ag water. The development of this new testing protocol is consistent with FDA's commitment to a new era of smarter food safety and fulfills one of the action items in the 2020 Leafy Greens STEC Action Plan.
So I was digging around the scientific literature because I was surprised that there weren't any registered products for pre-harvest treatment. And what I realized is there are some real challenges treating water pre-harvest. The closer you get to harvest, the stricter the standards are. You don't want a lot of residual chemicals on the food. It can have negative effects on the product sensory attributes, on the environment, and on human health. But some of the treatments that have been tried that have been used post-harvest, like chlorination or ozone peroxide, a lot of times the microbes are protected on the produce, either in crevices or just the item.
Well, maybe they're just intrinsically part of it, right? Because, you know, there's so much water in produce. I mean, it's part of it.
So what I found, and this is almost a 20-year-old article.
But Barbara, I really just want to say thank you, because you really just now answered my primary questions on this. Like, you know, I was surprised, too, that there wasn't anything. So thank you for that really thorough.
Well, the article that I found, now Trevor Suslow was at PMA now, but when he was at UC Davis, he wrote an article, and we can put a link to this in our show notes. It was published in 2001, but some of these things are still applicable today. But it said natural plant surface contours, natural openings, harvest and trimming wounds, and scuffing can be points of entry for the microbes into produce, but they can also be safe harbors. And so when the microbes are protected, these post-harvest treatments that I mentioned, like the chlorine and ozone, aren't effective. And so this is a real big challenge. So I was just curious about, I wonder what people are doing. Because if you're a backpacker, you take the little eyedropper of chlorine and put that in the water or use your filter. So I just thought that was interesting.
Well, and I guess it gets to, you know, the fact of some of the commentary about this is the fact that, you know, FDA officials are not able to get out and take samples from the farms. People are not allowing them access to the water on farms, so that they're not able to do, well, complete investigations. So, you know, we're sort of left without as much information. So, you know, hopefully this will produce some results. So, progress. And now, last but not least, this is my favorite story for today.
General Mills brand Pillsbury has announced that a variety of their refrigerated cookie and brownie dough products are now safe to eat raw. The products are marked with a special seal on the packaging. Pillsbury refined their process, now using heat-treated flour and pasteurized eggs. Other than that, the brand says it still uses the same recipe that consumers have become accustomed to. To clear up any confusion about this new product line and what makes their products safe to eat raw, Pillsbury does answer some frequently asked questions on their website, and they also list all of the specific products that are safe to eat raw. So we'll share a link to that in our show notes today.
This just made me so happy. You don't have to roll the dice anymore, right? I mean, look, it's all fine. I would love to be able to say I could resist. I cannot resist cookie dough. There's no way, and I'm sure I'm not alone. And so relief for parents all around that they can now, you know, let their kids have the fun treat of some cookie dough without worrying. And the fact that I think that this marks, I don't know, I think a significant move for a label of safe to eat raw. I mean, it's really educating consumers in the right way.
I would say that for parents who are going to give this to their kids, they need to make it into a teaching moment that, you know, they have to look on the label and make sure it says safe to eat raw before they do that. So they don't get the, so the kids aren't under the impression that all cookie dough is safe to eat raw. Just saying.
Anyway,
I know.
It's a good day.
I had to rain on your parade there, Stacey.
I just think it made me so happy because it's, you know, I mean, there have been lawsuits, right? I mean, this is we won't go down that hole. But yes, this is a big improvement. This is I think a major step. So yay, Pillsbury and General Mills. Good move.
You can read these stories and more on foodsafetymagazine.com. And if you're not already, you can follow all of our updates on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Just search for Food Safety Magazine.
All right, now it's time to pull up a chair and join the roundtable discussion on how the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance is meeting the challenges of all virtual training in the age of COVID. The panel of FSPCA lead instructors includes Connie Landis-Fisk, Northwest Regional Extension Associate for the Produce Safety Alliance, Amanda Evans Lara, Principal Food Safety Consultant and Compliance Specialist with HACCP Mentor, and Charles and Michael Kalish, I don't think they'll mind me doing this since they reference often the fact that they're twins, who are both managing members of Food Safety Guides.
It was great to talk to these guys. I learned more about managing these virtual platforms than I ever wanted to know. But it's good, that, you know, these types of trainings and information sharing can still take place, even though we can't all get together.
Mm-hmm. Well, this training has been pivotal in meeting the goals of FSMA, which is prevention and educating first and so on. So getting this type of training is imperative. Finding new ways to complete the training in our virtual, our now completely virtual reality is very important. All right. Are you in your chair? Pulling up that chair. Here we go. Now it's time for the interview.
First, I'd like to welcome all of you to the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to talking about how training has really evolved during this time, both for Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance and other kind of food safety training, because now we're in this new normal, and so we've had to adjust. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say about that. So I wanted to start by asking the four of you, what types of courses have you taught virtually, and what are your favorite platforms to use? Amanda, why don't we start with you?
Okay, thank you. My main choice has been in the last couple of months has been Zoom, but prior to that I did use a different platform, which worked quite well, but didn't have all the features that Zoom had. And probably the most common courses that I'm training is definitely the FSPCA Human Foods part two course, but I have been training that course for the last 3 years virtually anyway. So it wasn't really a massive jump for me to go into this new world because I had been doing that previously anyway. And there's been a whole heap, another suite of courses that I've also been doing relating to the HACCP principles and application, internal auditing, allergen management, a whole heap of different ones. But my main one is definitely the part two in the human foods PCQI course.
What about you, Charlie?
Yeah, I've led virtual courses for FSVP, the Preventive Controls for Human Food PCQI course, and also other courses. Like I just did a HACCP refresher the other day. And the platform that I've been using has been Zoom. I did experiment with some other platforms before, like GoToMeeting, another one that was based in the UK. The name is escaping me, but ultimately I ended up settling on Zoom. I do have a backup platform, Google Hangouts, because I use Google a lot. And that's pretty reliable, but it doesn't have the features that I like in Zoom.
So both of you have mentioned Zoom. Are there particular features that you really like that help you engage with the people taking the course?
I definitely think that being able to, your standard thing, the face to camera is very important during a course. If you can see somebody's face while you're training them, you can then judge whether they're getting the information that you're talking about, whether they're understanding the concepts, whether they're bored or not. So you're really looking for engagement. So my big thing is really having that camera on. But the other features around, I don't tend to use the hand raising feature because we do have that, the face to camera on. The chat box definitely, and the ability to put people in rooms. But probably my favourite feature is being able to record the session. Because my previous platform, Lecter Live, you were able to record it, but it didn't convert it to an easy format that you could, like an MP4 that you could then go through later on.
Hmm.
Yeah, Michael, my identical twin brother, he's here, and we both have used it with a number of features that we really like. We really like the chat feature and being able to, just on the fly poll people with questions. Being able to create polls in advance is useful, but the feature is a little bit limited, but it is useful and we do use it. The breakout rooms is really great. That was for us overcoming one of the chief problems with doing a virtual course. And I've been really happy with it. There are limitations to some of the features that we like. It's not, the perfect platform, but so far it's the best one. And those are features that we've really relied on. And maybe we'll talk about some more over the course of the webinar.
Sure. Michael, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just screen sharing. Although that's fairly common in most every video conferencing platform available. Screen sharing opens the World Wide Web for basically, demonstrating, showing, illustrating examples. So screen sharing is probably the feature that I appreciate most in a video conferencing platform. And fortunately, that one's pretty popular. And then also appropriating the different reactions that are available in Zoom. So there's a thumbs up and an applause. And appropriating those and letting the audience know that they can use those frequently. For me, the biggest challenge with these tools is keeping folks engaged. And so finding ways to do that, whether it be, through backdrops or reactions or any kind of engagement through the platform, I'm a proponent of.
And Connie, what sorts of courses have you been able to teach virtually?
So the Produce Safety Alliance, we have, due to COVID-19, created a temporary remote training policy for the PSA grower training course. So we're working with our PSA trainers across the country and around the world to be able to continue offering the PSA grower training even during these times when folks have to social distance and we can't meet face-to-face. So we've been using Zoom, as the others mentioned, and trying to really incorporate a lot of those built-in tools like breakouts and polling that were already mentioned, reactions, the nonverbal feedback. So you could ask simple yes, no questions and get that feedback right there. As Amanda mentioned, we also require that our attendees have their videos on and that we monitor them throughout the whole course for participation. So all of those tools have been really important to all our trainers. Some of our trainers have gone beyond that and inserted polling throughout their courses, or even used tools like annotations in Zoom have been really helpful. And then a lot of others have used tools that are outside of Zoom. So as was mentioned before, maybe like Google Docs or outside websites like Kahoot and Mentimeter, just anything we can do to kind of liven up that all-day training.
So I'm curious about this this next question I'm going to ask you. Amanda, you mentioned that you have been doing trainings virtually for years now, but for the rest of you, how much of an adjustment was it to convert an in-person training to one that was completely remote learning? I mean, I know how my college-age kids have maybe not so well adapted to the remote learning this spring. So just curious about how, you know, what did it take to pull that all together?
Sure. This is Charlie. In some ways, it's made policies that we might have been a little bit more loosey-goosey on in an in-person format, a little bit more rigid, because it's so much more important to take additional measures to make sure the people are engaging. And so in a way, we're actually asking more from participants in the virtual format. One of the first things that Michael and I did when we switched over to doing these virtual courses, and we had been in the habit of doing a lot of virtual stuff because as consultants, we consult people virtually all the time. That's like part of our whole model. We go on the cloud and work with clients around the world. So it wasn't a huge transition for us, but for transitioning the in-person format to the virtual format for a full course, which could be 20 hours, the first thing that we did was we sat down and wrote out our policies. Because we needed to be very clear to the people that are going to be in the course. We also need to be very aware ourselves of what we need to do in order to deliver a course to the standard that we want in a virtual format. And so that was a really great starting point. And from there, it really got us experimenting on Zoom and with other apps like Kahoot, which Connie mentioned, and really helped develop the course from there.
Can you, you know, specify some of the policies that you think are maybe a little more stringent now?
Oh, sure. For example, whether or not I'm going to issue a certificate. So I've incorporated a final exam. Before, I was actually sort of against final exams. I thought, you know what? You know, it creates a lot of anxiety and defeats the purpose of, you know, that we're here to learn. But with the training online and making sure that people get it, I kind of switched over and feel like that's important. And for other stricter policies, it includes, I mean, other strict policies would be, you know, getting that direct feedback from people, whether it's through chats, you know, like I mentioned that I do polls on the fly where I'll go, if I sense that people aren't paying attention, or if it's a good point that I want to assess people, see if they really got it. I'll be throwing out questions and saying, you know, chat me the response or give me a thumbs up. And if I'm not getting those responses, or if I'm getting lots of questions like, oh, can you repeat the question? I'm going to throw into suspicion whether or not they're actually participating. But there are some dangers to doing all that, because sometimes people might be struggling with the material and that's why they're asking me, or maybe English is not their first language. And so, assessments can be tricky like that, but, I've put a lot more focus on the assessment and making sure that they can demonstrate to me that they're getting the material. I'll try to come up with some other good, strict examples, but that's all that came off the top of my head.
And I can pick up where he left off actually and say that, you know, with, by incorporating Google Docs, we're able to see people contributing or participating in real time. And we did not have that with pencil and paper in our in-person formatted classes. And so that does add a new layer of visibility into people's understanding, or at least their, at a minimum, their participation in the activities.
I think that's a great idea with that too. I haven't really done the group Google Doc thing yet, but definitely have. I use Google Forms where they submit their activities through Google Forms. But I really like that idea of, if you've got a larger group, to be able to actually get them to all contribute to that one document.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to build on what Michael said about that is we realized real quick that because we made a Google Doc version of the exercise workbook for people in the class to use. And the first time I did that, I realized, oh my God, we need one of these documents for every breakout room because we want groups to work together. And it doesn't necessarily help if everybody is on the same document. So for our trainings, we start incorporating a Google Doc for each group or each breakout room. And we can arrange those Google Docs on a large monitor that we have and just see them all work like buzzing like bees on Google Docs at the same time. So we can see who's participating, who's not. And there are certain new policies that we had to create around that. But that really helped us, track people.
Yeah, and to add on that, and we'll stop building on each other in a second here, but you can use version history in Google Docs to also see where people have participated and when. So there is a degree of granularity you can dive into to evaluate participation. Unfortunately, they don't make trend reports available. Their trend reports relate more to like who's viewed the document, who's commented on the document. But you can see generally where people have participated. So that's a really nice feature that comes along with Google Docs as well.
Now, Connie, for your work with the produce safety trainings, how long did it take your group to get everything to go virtual?
It took us a couple weeks to really hammer out those policies. I think that's so important to have them very clear. We have such a large cadre of trainers that it was really important to us that we had that groundwork laid before we threw them all out into trainings. And then on top of that, we offered an office hour once a week. So if someone was new to Zoom, afraid of teaching in Zoom, a lot of us have attended Zoom meetings and webinars, but hosting a meeting and trying to juggle all that goes into that is a whole nother story. So there was a lot of trainer support in the first couple months, and now it's more of a one-on-one basis when folks have additional questions or they want to figure out how to do something in Zoom. But the first step was definitely laying out those policies and making sure that we were still going to be giving out a high quality training that we could feel confident that the growers attending that training were getting the information they needed to comply with the produce safety rule.
Now, did you have to go, were you doing everything in person prior to that and then
yes.
had to convert? Yeah,
that's correct. So the PSA grower trainings, the policy was that they were only allowed to be given face-to-face. It's important for trainers to understand their audience. And a lot of our audience needs that face-to-face. They need that connection. They need that chance to ask questions. They also benefit a lot learning from each other in the classroom. And we lose some of that in Zoom because they can't see each other. You don't have those opportunities to chat during breaks. I heard during introductions that you grow blueberries. I grow blueberries too. Here, I have a question. We don't get that in the Zoom room. So it's just different, but it's important if our trainers understand who their audience is, they can still tailor that remote course to meet their audience's needs.
I think with that, Connie, that importance, like I said before, I have that mandatory policy that everyone has their camera on, which also allows other class members to see each other. So I think that side of it with Zoom works really well. But it all comes down to obviously the technology that person is, having on their computer or whatever at the time.
And that certainly is a challenge because we have a lot of growers that are in very remote locations. They don't have great internet or bandwidth And so that's certainly a hurdle to teaching via Zoom, especially since we require that they keep their cameras on. That does take up a lot of their internet.
Connie, I wanted to ask, have you noticed some improvement in engagement with the participants taking your course? I mean, that seems to be really important for your training.
I think over the last few months, what we've seen is the trainers have become more confident and they're starting to use more engagement tools. And so naturally we're seeing, you know, the growers are having a better experience. We're starting to see some comments on the evaluations that come back to show that. So that's been very positive.
So you said that before you weren't doing anything virtually. So how much of a jump has it been to make all of your course materials available electronically? Has that been a difficult transition?
No. So for the Produce Safety Alliance Grower Training course, all our trainers already had the slides. So that makes it really easy to just present those in Zoom the same way they would do in a classroom. And we also still require that every attendee have a printed manual. So that has been a challenge because we have to then get those shipped across the country or sure. to other countries if that's where the attendees are. But they have that manual right in front of them. So they've got the slides on their screen in Zoom, and then they've got the manual open in front of them. So there hasn't been a challenge in that respect.
That's great. Charlie, you mentioned that you and Michael had to kind of make copies of different exercises in the workbooks for the different breakout rooms that mm-hmm. you had. How are you providing training materials to your participants for your courses?
Yeah, so in a couple ways. One, we will share digital, you know, PDF copies of the exercise workbook and the model food safety plan that we'll be working on. And we request that they print those and have them ready to go before the training starts. The Google Doc, that's a link that goes directly to a document, and it's a link with an expiration. So they have access to that for some amount of time after the course, and then it expires. There's a couple ways that we can transfer documents to them. Sometimes if it's, you know, small class, we might just do it through email, but otherwise we might do it through an expirable Google link, or it could be a Dropbox transfer, which is actually, I just sort of just found out about it. It's pretty cool. It's really easy to just quickly transfer files to people. We also encourage people to buy the hard copy of the participant manual. Our policy is if you register 2 weeks or more ahead of the training date, we will actually include in the price the hard copy of the manual and have it shipped to you. It has been a bit of an issue where, you know, we have late signups and we can't do that. So in which case we'd use the digital version. But with the virtual course, you know, I really want their attention front and center on the course, on, you know, each other, and not on juggling and managing like a whole bunch of windows and files and stuff like that. So for me, having a hard copy in front of you helps reduce that diffusion of the attention span across all these windows. So that's worked for me, and that's what and Michael, and that's what we've been encouraging.
So Connie, what's your opinion on the sweet spot of the number of participants?
Yeah, so for the PSA grower trading remote delivery, we encourage our trainers to keep the numbers to 20 or less. And again, most of those are taught by a training team, not just an individual trainer. So that kind of helps with both the trainer's fatigue and also the audience's fatigue, hearing that one voice for multiple hours. So most of those remote trainings are much smaller than that. I think a lot of growers want to wait until they're offered face-to-face again. They are not looking forward to that remote delivery model. And so a lot of folks are putting it off till fall. Also, now we're in the growing season. So this is naturally our slow time. There are fewer courses taught in the summer, and those that are tend to have lower attendance numbers anyway.
Now, Connie, you had mentioned about using a course monitor. Can you describe for our listeners what that looks like?
So, for example, if Amanda and I were teaching a PSA grower training course, while I'm teaching module one, Amanda could be monitoring everyone for participation. She could be paying attention to the chat and interrupting me when there's a question. She could make sure that everybody's video is on and they're still looking at their screen. And if they're not, she could send them a private chat to say, hey, is something going on? Are you having technical difficulties? Basically staying on top of all that other stuff so that I can focus on teaching. And then when she's teaching module two, I would take over those monitor duties. Now, if I was just teaching alone, or if I'm in an office that has other staff, anybody else could serve in that monitor role. They don't have to be a PSA trainer. So, for example, if I had a secretary or a student worker for the summer, they could also fill that monitor role. But it's basically just making sure that there's someone dedicated to, you know, all that other juggling so that the person presenting doesn't have to worry about it.
So for the rest of you, do you traditionally use monitors? Do you back each other up? Or you've all commented, Charlie, Michael, and Amanda, that sometimes it's just you. So how do you try and keep on top of making sure that participants are really paying attention and not multitasking?
Well, I think you can't completely stop that. But if you keep the engagement where they're having to do something every, say, 3 to 5 minutes is kind of the area that I look at, where they're having to engage, whether you're asking them a question on camera. And again, because I have such keep my numbers low, everyone's got their camera there. So you can have, it's like having that direct conversation face to face. So, you know, you can ask them that. You can ask them to do something in a chat. You can ask them to do an activity. I put a time limit on, you know, doing the activity. So there's a clock on the screen that they can see that. And they know that they have to have it submitted, because if you don't do the activities as part of, especially the part two human foods course, they don't get their certificate because they're not demonstrating that they understand the information that they went through in part one. So I think that's probably my biggest thing, is just to keep that engagement, getting people to do stuff, you know, every 3 to 5 minutes, and even just writing something on the whiteboard. That's another great feature of Zoom as well. You can actually get them to put their thoughts on the whiteboard, and they have to do that. You know, so that works quite well.
Yeah, on our end, yeah, it's kind of like what Amanda was saying, where we're peppering them with assessments, attention checks. I've been in some virtual presentations and things where they might do an attention check where they say, what's your favorite color? And what I try to do is, you know, I think that I can come up with that without having been paying attention. So I tend to come up with some kind of attention check that's related to what we're covering right now or what we've covered in the last few minutes. And it can be really evident right away if they were paying attention or not, or if they're experiencing some kind of issue that maybe I didn't notice before. So we often use the nonverbal cues, nonverbal communication, you know, like, hey, does everybody get this? And can I get a thumbs up, you know? And that is, you know, just a small amount of engagement, but just enough to deter them, hopefully, from, you know, trying to multitask. And, you know, when I first started, this is all like learned from experience, because when I first started, I remember looking at my screen, somebody was just going through their mail, you know? Like not email, their mail. They were opening letters and all that. So just from experience, you know, you kind of figure out when you're doing these virtual courses what works and what doesn't, and over time you kind of refine it. Otherwise, I think I just give up doing virtual courses.
This is Michael. I often find that creating a sense of familiarity between folks also helps with engagement, because then you can, it is so easy to lose people just by virtue of them being fairly anonymous. If you're checking the list of folks on your, you know, on your Zoom call, and you're saying, okay, next question is for John, because you've spotted John in the list, you know, to me that doesn't, you know, this sort of randomness for me doesn't necessarily replace familiarity with John and John's last name and John, you know, what John likes to do and relating things to what John likes to do. And as I frame a question or pose a scenario. And so creating a sense, using a certain portion of your time for each day to create some degree of familiarity with the folks in the class will help make the material more relatable and help keep engagement up. That's pretty obvious, probably most folks.
Sure. How do you do the assessments? Before you issue a certificate, you need to make sure that the participants actually learn the information that you were training them on. So what are some of the tools that you're using to assess whether the participants are really understanding the material? Amanda, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So I think we've said this before, using Google Docs and Google Forms for me works really well, especially with Google Forms because, again, we can put a time limit, and I think having a time limit for the activity is really important. And you can then generally, you know, you can extend it by 5 minutes if you need to be. There'll be participants who finish the activities really quickly, but there'll be others that require it to be a bit longer. So the beauty of Google Forms is I can have that open just in a portion of my screen, and I can see when the answers are coming in, and I can do a quick review of their answers. And then what Google Forms does is it does these really nice graphs around, you know, what people answered. So then I can share those results. The class can't see who, obviously, you know, whose answers what, but the nice pie graph, okay, well, 50% of you agreed to this answer and 50% agreed to that. You know, the correct answer is X. Why did you say this? And then that engages more conversation then. So I find Google Forms works really well with that. And the two other activities, probably the more in-depth ones, being that this is for the FSPCA course for human foods, is the doing the hazard analysis and also doing the allergen management activities. Both of those, I have people fill out a Word document, and this obviously can be converted to the Google Doc as well, and they fill that out and then they email that back to me. And because they're two of the main concepts for me, people really need to know how to do, especially that hazard analysis, because that informs everything going forward. So you really need to get that right. So they'll put that, like I said, on a Word document, and then they'll email that back to me. So that's kind of what's worked for me. Some of the other activities, it will just be a verbal. We'll have a discussion, an open discussion with all the mics on, and people can jump in and say what their experience is. And especially when we start talking around product recall, have you ever been through a recall? And even from a point when we're doing the section on physical hazards, we do the recap in part two, I'll always ask, okay, have you ever had something in your food that shouldn't have been there? So generally people will start talking about, you know, in their business, what they've experienced. But then I like to say, okay, what about you personally? Have you ever been to a restaurant and found something that shouldn't have been there? Or have you bought a product? Yeah, so that gets all that engagement up again. So there's a couple of different methods that I prefer to use.
Good. How about you, Connie?
So for the Produce Safety Alliance grower training, we do not have a formal assessment. Some of our training teams use a pre and post test for reporting purposes. And they're doing that using either Zoom polls or a Qualtrics survey. And to keep it anonymous, they can assign, if they're using Qualtrics to keep it anonymous, they assign each participant a code number so that they can put the same number on their pretest and post-test to link them.
Interesting. Okay, Michael.
Yeah, I use Google Forms as well. You know, Charlie's going to speak, I think, in greater depth about Kahoots, which I'm a huge fan of. But on Google Forms, I guess one thing I wanted to mention was that I like shuffling the question order. And you can do that through settings, going to presentations. You can select shuffle question order. So if you are concerned about people communicating about, you know, what their answers are, that's a quick workaround. I am you know, Charlie and I both have teaching credentials. We another lifetime ago, Charlie was science, I was math. And we had experience giving standardized tests to kids, K through 12. And I've just never been a really big fan of standardized testing. And I think, especially with folks in the food industry, where maybe, you know, in part they went that direction because, you know, they didn't like sitting in a desk answering standardized tests. So I often like to give people an opportunity to, and this is an advantage of having a small class, but have an opportunity to give me really like an oral exam result. So I could sit down and ask them some questions. They can communicate to me in their own way, their understanding of the content. And if they can do that, I'm not really caring too much what kind of test score they get. But certainly having a test score is something to refer to. I guess I just don't always think of it as being, you know, the best form of assessment. It's just really convenient for especially large class sizes where you just don't have the time or opportunities to have that face-to-face. But normally if I do see some people, failing in the assessments, I'll pull them aside at the end of the course and ask them to talk with me and communicate to me their understanding of certain concepts. And they just can't do it there. Then clearly we have a problem on my side for the teaching and their side for the learning. So, that's my approach.
Yeah. Sure. I think one of the other things we have to remember too is like, what is the purpose of our course? What is it that we want people to do? And generally it's not to be able to stand there and answer 50 questions thrown at you by the FDA if, you know, when they come and have a look at your food safety plan or something like that. It's to be able to show that you can actually put together a food safety plan as it relates to the PCQI qualification. So I always, when I'm looking at how I or what type of assessment methodology I'm going to use, I have to come back to, okay, what is it that we want people to walk away with? Do I want them to be able to say off the top of their head, you know, how to do X, Y, Z, or do I want a different outcome? So that really drives my assessment methodology as well.
Sure. Now, do you each think that some part of virtual training will continue into the future? I know, Connie, you mentioned in the fall that growers are looking forward to getting back to in-person training. Will you keep a component of something virtual, or will it be completely in-person?
The intention is to go back to all face-to-face grower trainings. We also have an online option, so folks can take the course over a three-week period through eCornell. So that's another option. But the intention is that this remote training policy is just temporary during COVID-19.
I know, Amanda, you mentioned that you've been doing virtual for a number of years. Will you do any in-person training once things quiet down?
Look, if it's a in-house course, definitely. And I have done that over the last 20 years anyway. But my model, my business model now is more virtual, and that's really to tailor to those people who don't have the time to travel or cannot afford to do the travel. So that, for me, works quite well. And I'm probably at the point in my career, I'm a little bit old and cranky now, that I really don't want to be traveling all over the countryside anymore. I like sleeping in my own bed instead of hotel beds. Yeah. You know, I think that's a young person's game.
So, Charlie, what do you and Michael think about, do you think there will be some component of virtual going forward?
Yeah, you know, we've made being virtual, like our virtual consulting has been a big part of our business model. So I definitely see us doing a lot more virtual courses in the future. It's hard to say what's going to happen with how COVID-19 is going to change, you know, what we think is normal. And if more and more people there's going to be more demand for virtual courses. I have a suspicion that's going to be the case, but we've had so much experience with, industry professionals who just really value the in-person training. I see us doing both. And Michael and I are, we're okay with that right now. The position that we're at right now and where we're at in life. Ultimately, we do see you doing a lot more virtual courses. Michael, what you have thought about that?
Yeah, I also like sleeping in my own bed and, you know, flying. I mean, especially flying right now and for the foreseeable future, it doesn't seem appealing at all. And but the real trick is how do you get a lot of folks, especially where internet bandwidth is just not available? How do you get them to sign on for remote learning? And that's going to be a real struggle. I think that's going to be the struggle of our time. And but the more that we can teach online, I think the better for everybody. I mean, it saves a lot of expense. You could, you know, for how much a company might spend on my hotel and meals, you could add one or two more people to a training. And I would rather see more informed people making food than me having to stay at the Holiday Inn.
That's a good point. So as we wrap up today, now, unfortunately, Connie, you are going to have to pick just one, but I'm, you know, with lots of, you know, food safety managers and their plants trying to train people, doing a lot of the training, virtually, what one piece of advice would you give someone who's trying to put together a training program that's only online? You want to start, Connie?
Sure. So my one piece of advice to our training teams is to practice before the day of your training. I think that the teams that have done that have had a much better experience, and the growers that have attended the training have had a much better experience because they've worked out all the kinks ahead of time. They know how they're going to use the different engagement elements. They've practiced it. And so everyone's a lot calmer day of the event.
Oh, great advice. How about you, Amanda?
I think building on what Connie just said, being very familiar with your technology, and that plays into that whole practicing as well. If you know the tools that you're going to be using, that's one thing that you're not going to be stressing about is, oh, how do I use this, or where do I find this button, or how do I drop a document into Zoom, or, you know, how do I use Google Docs? You know, if you can be familiar with all of those tools, it's going to, you know, it's just one less thing you have to worry about. Then you just have to worry about the participants not understanding the technology. But in saying that, Zoom's got that great feature that people can get on before the course and, you know, make sure everything's going to work and familiarize themselves with the platform, which is something I encourage all of my participants to do. And I also see that Zoom just came out. I got an email yesterday around, because there's been a lot of questions around their security, that you now cannot set up a session that doesn't include a password or a waiting room. So I need to go in and check, well, how does that affect the participant wanting to have a bit of a test run? To make themselves familiar with the layout of the classroom, the virtual classroom.
Good point.
Yeah, for me, I mean, doing this virtual course, I know this is hyperbole, but, you know, I remember hearing a story about somebody watching a space launch and saying, I just watched 10,000 things not go wrong, right? I mean, in a way, I feel like the best advice I can give is have a plan. So that means, you know, make an investment in looking into what it takes to lead a successful virtual course. Because if you think you're going to wing it, you'll probably be disappointed. I know I was. I thought, oh, we can do that. The first PCQI course that I did, that Michael and I did together, was an utter disaster. So, you know, have a plan, make an investment in it, and just be ready to make mistakes and have a piece of paper next to you and take notes. Every training I do, I have a notebook and I'm making notes. Oh, do that differently next time. Okay, maybe do this or add that. So it's always something that's improving. I don't know if that'll ever stop, but So have a plan, because there's nothing worse than a training going wrong, especially if you got like 19 more hours, right?
Right.
And I think having that plan for backup with what happens when your internet connection drops out, how are you going to contact the students to say, look, sorry, we're having a disaster here, or our power's just gone out in the house, or there's a thunderstorm, or I've had all of those things happen. And I think at the beginning, Charlie had said having that backup platform to use, just in case if Zoom failed for whatever reason, what's your backup platform? So I actually send those details out to people before the course starts to say, this is what our backup plan will be. And it might be something as simple as there's an app called Appearing, or you might use Google Hangouts. I think that's what Charlie said, that
right.
Charlie and Michael use. That could be an option. I think they've changed their name, actually. I think they're calling it Keep now. Google Hangouts that came out last week.
Michael and I actually did a little experiment where, what if my internet went out in my house and I couldn't do in my home office and I couldn't do the presentation? I downloaded the Zoom app and I was able to have the presentations in slides and on my Google Drive. And I was actually able to deliver the full PCQI training on my phone using cellular. So I don't even need Wi-Fi. So that was a really great thing that we discovered, that we were like, okay, we feel a little more confident, you know, if things really go haywire.
So your backup had a backup.
Yeah, that's the secret.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that.
Any last thoughts, Michael?
No, I mean, I agreed with what all the participants here said. I think having a backup for each part of the presentation would be important. From a technology standpoint, obviously, if you need to step out, having a second person there to support you is valuable. Probably the perfect storm that I've seen has been people who maybe their English is not very strong and they are having technical difficulties. So prepare for the worst. How are you going to communicate with somebody whose communication skills are limited and whose technology is failing them? And maybe it means cycling them to the next training, as was mentioned earlier. Or maybe it means taking a break. And if you can take a break, how does that affect other people's schedules? So maybe think that through first before pulling the plug or hitting go on a new idea you have.
Great. Well, certainly we have talked about a lot of challenges and the evolution of training, and we'll have to see how things look down the road, how much virtual stays as a part of what we do for training in the food safety area. I want to thank the four of you for joining me, and our technology was successful today with getting all of you on. Certainly appreciate the four of you taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
We want to thank all our guests today. Connie Landis-Fisk, Amanda Evans-Lara, Charles and Michael Kalish for joining us on the podcast today. And thanks, of course, to all of you for listening. You can find links to all the references we've mentioned in the episode in our show notes. You can access those in your podcast player or on our website at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast, then find episode 77. Please don't hesitate. He asked you earlier, we're asking you again. Send us questions and suggestions, or just a hi, how are you, to podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com, or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. You can make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your feed by clicking that subscribe button. That's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on August 25th. Take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.